Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I'd like to welcome you all to the program and give you the number if you'd like to call in. It's area code 267-521-0167. Grab a pen. 261-521-0167. And keep that pen and paper nearby because we're going to have lots of information to give out tonight, as always. These are open lines. First-time callers, entirely welcome. You have something you want to talk about that has something to do with psychiatry, you give a call and let's talk. We don't have to agree. We just have to be respectful. And right now, our society is in some desperate need for respect. We are in definite jeopardy. And I want to guess who that is, but I don't want to guess. So line 202, your line is open.
Hey, Yvonne, this is Yvonne. I thought I would come on at the top of the show this time.
Fabulous. Thank
yeah,
you.
We have to agree one thing, that we are in jeopardy. And if we, it is a slippery slope that we're on. And it's not just people who have psychiatric history. It can be anyone that either currently in the past or future might touch psychiatry or might find themselves labeled. And I say that so wide now because the new DSM-5 just about, there's probably no one that couldn't find some classification if someone wanted to have you involved in some kind of intervention that you didn't want. Even the First Lady of the Land, one of our former First Ladies, two of our First Ladies have had electroshock treatment.
Yeah, well, Jackie was, I believe, a senator at that point. Because it seems to have happened in Massachusetts. And it seems to have happened due to a fight that spilled out onto the street between her and JFK. And so I don't think that the street would have been available at the White House. I think time-wise. But still the first lady of Massachusetts, right? And this is something that happens to people, and we need to inform people about it. But the night, I've done some research into it since that first night when it came out, and I was mistaken in saying that it was while she was First Lady. It was prior to that.
Saying that it was two First Ladies, but it was Kitty Dukakis who wrote a book with someone who had electroshock.
Yes.
It was voluntary. So
the only can we have?
From Massachusetts. And
I thought we had more.
Hello?
What is this about Massachusetts and torture? I mean, isn't
Harvard.
That David?
It's about Harvard, Yvonne. It's about Harvard. I mean, I don't want to say it's only about Harvard because, of course, it's not only about Harvard, but Harvard has something to do with that. Harvard has something
David
to do with
Isn't that in Massachusetts?
I'm sorry?
The David Rottenberg Center, is that in Massachusetts or New York?
The Judge Rottenberg Center. Yeah, no, that's Massachusetts, but I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it's 60% of the budget for the Judge Rottenberg Center comes from New York taxpayers because they ship, it's illegal to do in New York. It was banned, I think, in 07 or something, but they do have carve-outs still. We're not entirely good. But they send New York kids to the Judge Rottenberg Center, and they advertise. The Judge Rottenberg Center advertises. And of course, they're the only people in the world who say, like, how terrible these medications are for your children. And then they don't tell you that what they're going to be doing is putting skin shocks all over them and torturing them, like, the way that you wouldn't even do to a animal. But it's because they're allowed to treat us like animals. It's very, very, very frustrating.
I know they've had some, if anybody who, you know, that got a weak stomach probably shouldn't see this, but
I know that on YouTube they, well, there was actually a case. A parent took the Judge Rodenberg, well, it may have been several by now, have taken the Judge Rodenberg Center to court. And they actually showed the film because I don't know, but for, maybe you could explain, why is it the center filmed it?
Oh, they have video cameras all over the place. The entire thing is being monitored with video cameras. They have a room. If you go on to their website and look at their promotional video where they don't mention that they're electroshocking kids and that kids are young people are in environments of where other young people are being electroshocked, and so like the trauma of being in a place where this can happen to you is compounded by that and aids in the compliance of all of the people there. But they show you a room that looks like, you remember the Jetsons and the computer room that George Jetson would have to sit in with like 30 lines of monitors in front of him and that his finger like would get like screwed up from having to hit the button all day long? Well, they have a room like this and the entire facility, the entire institution is monitored with video cameras. And so my belief is that it got leaked and then that's how it got into court, or they mandated the video footage of it, one or the other. But he was severely traumatized, one of the big cases that they came down on legally. And he was severely traumatized, and if you Google JRC electroshock, this is different than the electroconvulsive treatment that we're usually talking about for people who may not understand this. The electroshock, electroshock, which causes a grand mal seizure by coursing 100 to 190 volts of electricity through your brain, is what we've done the specials on and things like that. This electric shocking that the Judge Rottenberg Center, JRC, does is where they put skin, they attach electric shocking pads. It's just so horrifying. It's hard to even, like, grab my head around it. And the staff have, like, buttons that they can push where they can then cause a shock on the skin, which, you know, they say is like a bee sting and literally, like, leaves welts and burns on these children's bodies. It's absolutely horrifying and torture. And the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture has made it clear that this is torture. Yeah. So that's, so the
so
video,
this,
they...
So isn't this more so like, I would compare it more like taking a cigarette button, burning somebody, because they give a lot.
Yeah.
It's not just a little, it's not like a little slap, like someone says, well, you know, my 3-year-old, I'll slap him on his fingers. It's not like that. It's, there's a lot of them going on. So
it's an electric shock, and it burns the skin, and it causes severe pain. And, you know, the video getting to the public, and it was, a judge finally said that they had to allow cameras in the courtroom, but for, I think, years, JRC successfully buried that video from the public's eye. And they call this behavior modification, and it's an aversive technique. I'm using their language, but that's how they talk about it, that this is like a therapeutic intervention and that this is going to teach somebody how it is that they're supposed to behave well. And it's like rooted right back to B.F. Skinner and the whole idea of reward and punishment and token economies. I mean, the institutions are built on these things, right? And so it's very, very bad. And the article that I saw that got posted earlier, that for no reason, Andre, I believe, was this young man's name who the big court case happened on, or one of the court cases anyway. And they told him to take off his jacket, and he didn't take off his jacket. And then they shocked him like 30-some-odd times put him in a state of acute stress response, wound up having to, like, go to another hospital, and, like, you know, his mother is heart-wrenching when his mother is describing it and saying how she would, like, wave her hand in front of his face, and he just looks straight ahead, that he was totally and completely traumatized. And then that they use this most often. They use it either for, like, kids who, like, all cursing or you know, not complying with whatever ridiculous behavior is expected of them. But then the group of people that it's most used on is young people who aren't verbal yet and who haven't developed really being able to express themselves through words. And so that, to me, is just absolute torture and so absolutely inhuman, and it's such a crime of what has, you know, to use it punitively is one thing, but then to literally use it as, like, your best means of communicating with somebody who doesn't speak a language you speak, like, that just seems friggin' wrong to me.
But this is so well documented that, I'll put it up later on, but it's so well documented that if you go just put in Judge Rodenberg Center abuse video, there is just so much.
Newscast, yeah.
It's I have stopped counting, it's at least 100. And one of the stations, I'm surprised Fox said a lot about this, but there are at least 100 different videos of reports of actually the videos themselves of parents, testifying. That's why I'm so surprised that some of the news media, that they haven't come out on certain other things, but they have covered this very well. I mean, I guess
And there's a Facebook page. It's Occupy JRC. If you're on Facebook, the Occupy JRC, and they give great updates there as to what's going on. And the FDA just ruled, I believe, that this was had to be taken off the market, or that it was torture. There was some big ruling, and I'm blanking on it right now. I apologize. I'll try to remember.
You mean the device that they use? Because
the
they
device.
Have a collar on the kid, like they're a dog or something, right?
Right, and you know, and when you think about, like, what the animal rights activists and advocates do, if you talk about shocking, you know, putting a shock collar on a dog, like, people are up in arms. But yet, like, there are all of these kids that this is being used as a form of psychology, like behavioral psychology. B.F. Skinner, who also wrote Walden 2, for any of you who are interested in a dystopian or utopian, and I don't know, it's a little twisted to me. But this guy did not believe, this doctor, Skinner, did not believe that we had souls and that we were just animals that needed to be trained and that we responded to reward and punishment. And if it was on an uncertain schedule, we would be more likely to comply because it could always be the next time that we got the treat. And like, this is, like, literally the basis of, like, behavioral psychology. John Watson, when I'm always talking about, like, the What Any Psych 100 student window, that's, like, John Watson's Little Albert study of where what the good doctors were trying to figure out is whether or not they could condition fear into an infant. The good doctors.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, the ethics of all this. In Skull's madhouse, Meyer wound up firing Watson because they were all at Johns Hopkins at the Phipps Clinic. And Meyer wound up firing Watson because Watson had gotten busted in having a second affair. And Meyer... Watson did not get removed from the Phipps Clinic at Johns Hopkins University because of the unethical experimentation he was doing on little Albert and trying to condition fear into another human being. He got removed from his position because he got busted having an affair. This is like in 19, I don't know, I want to say 30 or something like that. 1920.
But you have to get pen and paper in hand when you listen to the show. You have to have pen and paper. But there's a lot of information here, and we want to make sure that you have that information. And also, is the toll-free number for the lower 48 still available?
Yeah, for the lower 48, it's, I just had it a minute ago. Yes, so if for a limited amount of time we were able to get this toll-free line to test it out and see, and so it's a rare occasion, 855-346-3351. So if you're listening and you're not calling in because you don't have long distance, this is toll-free in the lower 48 states of the United States, 855-346-3351. And if you want to call in on the regular line, it's 267-521-0167. And I please, if you're out there listening, call in and let me know what you're thinking, because there are so many things going on and we have to really continue to speak out. I do have a couple of updates about the involuntary outpatient commitment bill in New York that was put forward on Friday. Excuse me. This morning I talked with people at Senator Young's office, Senator, all different people's offices, and I wound up finding out that it looks like S-2225D 2013, which is the expansion of Kendra's law, involuntary outpatient commitment programming in New York, and would also sunset and repeal, would prevent us from repealing the law as it is now. It would become permanent, yeah. They would make it immediately permanent. It's not supposed to become a permanent law in New York until 2017. It could still sunset before then. In other words, be taken off the books. But this law would prevent that from happening and would make it permanent now if it was passed. So it's my understanding that there's the session ends June 19th, and to the best of my knowledge, and I called the leader's office, Senator Skelos's office, to the best of my knowledge, it is not on the calendar now, and it probably will not appear on the calendar before the end of the session. But that doesn't mean that it won't. And so we have to stay vigilant, and we have to call our senators, and there's no sponsor in the assembly right now, I also found out, and so that means calling your assembly people and telling them now, before there's a crisis, who you are and what you're about and what you stand for and what you would like them as a person in their district that votes for them to do. I think we need to really stay on top of that. But to the best of my knowledge, at the moment it's not on the calendar, so it won't be voted on. And it can't be, because there's no assembly sponsor. So that's somewhat good news. And also today I talked with community affairs, and Detective Martinez has always been absolutely wonderful in supporting efforts to remember Esmond Green. And so we're set to have a small vigil on June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m., and on 410 Winthrop Street in Brooklyn, and that is in front of Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room on June 19th, which will be the sixth anniversary of Ms. Green's murder by neglect at that institution. And so we will hold a small vigil in remembrance of Ms. Green and all others who have lost their lives to psychiatry and who are trying to survive and struggle their way through, and to speak out against psychiatric oppression.
And for people who don't know, because, you know, we have different people coming on who are at different stages of awareness. Esmond Green was a woman who was in the emergency room in Kings County Hospital. And, again, this is where people have video cameras. She was there, and she actually fell out of the chair. And I can't remember, she was there for what, was she there for 2 hours?
On the ground, she was laying on the floor for several hours, I believe, long enough for security to roll, you know, sitting on a rolling chair. The security guard rolls his chair over to the corner of the wall, looks over, looks at her. You can see all of this. It's amazing that the camera happened to catch all of this. You can see her look at her and then roll away. So one of my questions is, A, how common is it to see people laying face down on the floor in an emergency room that the security guard doesn't immediately jump up and say, what's going on here? And B, when the facility staff finally came to get her, the woman nudged her with her foot, like kicked at her, not hard, but like nudged, but still used her foot to like be like, come on, get up. And then they realized that she had died. But they falsified the records. And because, of course, they didn't know there was videotape of this, they tried to cover it up. And by some, you know, coincidence of sorts, while the camera is catching Miss Green writhing on the floor, dying, in her records it said that she was up and going to the bathroom.
She had been waiting in the psychiatric emergency room for nearly 24 hours when she toppled from her seat at 5:32 a.m. June 19th, face down on the floor. She was dead by 6:35 when someone on the medical staff flagged down that person in the waiting room, finally approached and nudged Green with her foot. That's what you're talking about. And gently prodded her shoulders as if to wake her. The staff then left and returned with someone wearing a white lab coat who examined her and summoned help. Until the staffer's appearance, Green's collapse barely caused a ripple. Hospital police officers and members of the hospital staff appeared to notice her prone body at least 3 times, but made no visible attempt to see if she needed help. One hospital police officer didn't even leave his chair, rolling it around a corner to stare at the body, then rolling away a few moments later.
I'm not exaggerating. This is one of the things that, like, when I start talking about things, especially if I'm in class, and I'll start going off like on a tangent of, because I'm so you know, bothered by the fact that any of this is legal and sanctioned and paid for. And then I'll show them the video of what it was I was talking about or something, and I'll be like, see, I wasn't exaggerating. This is really what happened. And so, like, sometimes I think people can't get their heads around it because the image and the optics that the industries have created to the general public, who doesn't come anywhere near this ordinarily, is that this is such a good thing now. That, yes, it was bad before, but it's so good now that they can't really get their heads around the idea that this is not really helping people. And it's certainly not ending any problems in our very, 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 very desperately desperate society at this moment in time.
People are treated with such disrespect. You know, just as what you were saying is that we are treated as subjects, as animals,
we really are, and I'm so concerned about this. Jared and Amanda Miller situation in Nevada on so many levels, and it's so troubling on so many levels. But I'm gonna say something that's probably gonna, you know, tick off some whole section of the population, but whatever. I really feel like if these two people had been people of color, that we would be having an entirely different discussion right now about two police officers and a civilian being dead. I do not think we would be having the same conversation that's being had. And it's very, very, very concerning.
Well, it's like, I guess this is the season we're in. Some people, because they have access to the press, they want to make everything to be mental health. Now, these people, I don't know very much about the case, except for they evidently shouted out that this is the beginning of a revolution.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had posted something yesterday saying, why can't we just have domestic terrorism? Why has everything happened?
Well,
to
here's the thing, because where is my article there? I tend to look at these things more than I should probably and give them more attention than I probably should. But that being said, I did go look and find Facebook pages and try to find information. And one of the posts that the alleged shooter, Jared Miller, put up on his Facebook page on June 3rd was an article that came out in the LA Times on June 2nd entitled, Holder Announces Task Force on, quote, Homegrown Terrorists. And so this is where the conversation is leading, and in the media, and they're not going after people who have psychiatric histories at the moment. They're going after.
Like I said, I don't know very much about Jared Miller, but the information I do have is that he has quite a lengthy criminal history. You know, he's a drug dealer. You know, he's got a long list of criminal things that are against him. So, unless, you know, he was convicted of, I'm checking this out now, in June 2001, he was convicted of third-degree malicious mischief. In February 2001, he was convicted of third-degree theft. Now, see, I think laws that say that if you've done this kind of history that you shouldn't be able to get guns, he has got DUI. I mean, these are the type of things if you have gun laws that you would present someone like this. This is someone I would say shouldn't have a gun.
613, your line is open. We lost the caller. If you're having trouble getting in, I see it bouncing back and forth. Try again, and hopefully that'll work. I think it's definitely a slippery slope, but I also think that when you look at the end of the day actions that were taken, the way the media responds is definitely troublesome. In how the coverage happens, and whether or not how it is people are being positioned and what's being talked about, I think it's very complicated, and I think the same way the society is being misled by the media about psychiatry, they're being misled by all kinds of biases within the media, too. And, you know, media shows talk about this all the time. The 24-hour news networks, I mean, this is what half of the time they spend talking about the other side, you know. But
this is going to quickly fade because this is not going to – it's unfortunate to say this, but I was told this, that when people get assigned a story, they get a one or two sentence byline, and this is not going. This is just another shooting. I mean, they shot. This is something that in D.C. This is like I don't know why it rises to national news, but you know, they're going to be searching. I'm quite sure they're going to comb all this guy's postings, all his letters and everything to try to find something in it. But somewhere in America, there's always, there is someone. We got 300 million people, and we got lots of guns. So, you know, a rampage like this can be just somebody that just got it in their mind that they're just angry. You say this a lot, Lauren, that, you know, a lot of this is just about anger.
But sometimes it's also, I mean, and here's where the big confusion starts to come in, that sometimes it's, and I'm not in any way supporting anything that these people did. I think this is heinous, and I feel for the people who have lost loved ones, and I'm not in any way being supportive of what Jared or Amanda Miller did, just in case you're tuning in and you're hearing this out of context. But it's also about political thought. And so we're in such a dangerous world, and we're conditioning young people from birth of how it is that they're supposed to live, and there are many, many, many problems inside of that. Area code 613, your line is open. Is this
Hi,
working?
Hi, Sue. How are you doing? Yvonne and Lauren, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I wanted to say something about you have to be careful of the person you vote for because they are the people that make the laws. People have to be informed, okay? Here, right now, on Thursday, here in Ontario, we have a vote for the provincial members, okay? And anyhow, I wanted to ask a very good question. Why do family doctors always refer people to psychiatrists? And why are they not doing their homework, going on Google to find out that psychiatric drugs are dangerous and that electroshock is dangerous? They're not doing their jobs properly. As soon as I went in, I saw a family doctor a few years ago. I said, hey, don't even talk about anything, I mean, if I'm depressed. I'm an anti-psychiatry, person. And she didn't ask why or nothing. They're always in a hurry. They only have the 15 minutes to be with a patient, and that's all they get paid for. Even my own doctor, he goes and teaches at the University of Ottawa. I told him I don't like psychiatry. He never asks why. I mean, he is a good doctor for most medical things, and I'm getting sick and tired of family doctors always saying, one time, as soon as me and Stephen got married, Stephen was a bit upset, and he went to see a family doctor who said, I'm going to send you to your shrink, and he said, no way, I'm not doing that. But I'm sick and tired of doctors not doing their homework, and that people are not doing their homework on the way they vote. The way they vote is what makes the lawmakers, and a lot of these lawmakers, I mean, as we know, are not too good at all, eh? So I think that's all I have to say tonight.
Go ahead, Lauren.
I was just going to say, I think it's really good points, and I appreciate you calling in, and I think that this is where people do need to know who they're voting for and to vote, and in between voting to keep in touch with your legislators and, you know, let them know that what you want and that you're watching and that, you know, you're part of a group of people who feel this way. And I think that that is so important in places where they don't have the right to vote. And, you know, I mean, even though, like, we can get into a 3-hour conversation about how it's all a scam, you know, electoral voting and things like that. Mm-hmm. But still, and definitely at the local level, people should be using your power of your vote in order to be able to talk to these people who are making laws. And we should be holding the legislators responsible for knowing the other side of the story and for not just dismissing it because the people who are going to profit at great, you know, windfall profits are going, you know, are giving them one side, saying that our side isn't credible. And every time somebody says that our side isn't credible, instead of saying, wait, this is what needs to be said, they're making our movement less credible, in my mind.
And well, I think we have to tell our family doctors, too. We have to inform family doctors of our views and why. Because the next person coming in, Johnny or Susie, I'm depressed. Oh, I'm terrible. Okay, they're depressed. Okay, Susie, we'll give you some Prozac. Oh, Joe comes, I lost my job. Okay, we'll give you something else, see? Like a Abilify.
Right.
We have to inform the doctors, all our medical people, why we're anti-psychiatry and why. We have to teach everybody that we know, our mothers, our fathers, our daughters, our uncles, our nieces, the pharmacists, everybody we meet, say, this is why I say no to psychiatry. And then people should go to the colleges of the medical doctors and try to speak to all the pre-med students to get them in the mindset, right before they are a full-fledged doctor. We got to get out to the doctors. They are the most powerful. They have the pen to write that prescription and get someone hooked to a shrink. Okay, John, I'm going to send you to Dr. Jones there.
Absolutely.
There at your local psych hospital. We got to inform one.
It's a pipeline. It's a pipeline in. It absolutely is. Yvonne, I also heard you trying to say something. What was that?
What I was saying is that some parts of medicine, and I understand the position that psychiatry is not medicine, they've abandoned their role. And I was very fortunate to come into the studying of Dr. Mary Ellen Copeland. And in rap, one of the things the doctors should be doing, and I don't think all of them do that, but some people abdicate it because they think they're going to be at risk. They listen to the same news stories that we listen to. And if we didn't have the history that we had, we'd believe everything too. When a person comes in and has a complaint, you know, you want to rule out any obvious things that are wrong. There are so many reasons why a person might not have, you know, even if you do believe that if somebody's coming to the stance, there might be some illness. A person could be, some things that look like emotional distress can be diabetes. Some things that look like emotional stress should be HIV. And you shouldn't just write a prescription. And I think what Sue asked the question was, why do they refer to psychiatry? I think it's because they really don't want to be bothered with monitoring the medications. And somehow it looks like in medical school, you know, instead of chemicals being the last resort, that it's the first line. And they don't want to be bothered with monitoring the chemicals. And so that they refer it to somebody else because they themselves, I think they think that it's something that doesn't have really anything to do with medicine. You know, they've kind of abdicated their role. The same thing with some therapists, not everybody, but in some situations, you know, what happens is you got a person, they got a thick pad, they do a 15-minute med check, and that's all they do. Now, I was surprised in asking over the years some people about, you know, their visits to their doctor and therapist, and I'm talking about 50-minute therapy sessions. They said, what 50-minute therapy session? We're talking about 15 minutes every 90 days. So I think that's the answer to it, and Sue has hit it on the head. You have to go into the medical schools, you know, doing the grand rounds or whatever else, and to educate them because these chemicals are so strong and they cause more problems. It's like, you know, the patient was okay. They may have had some distress, and maybe for a lot of people, if nothing was done, if there was no chemical intervention at all. If you just let it run its course, over half the people would be okay. But the fact is, after many years or decades or so of taking these chemicals, then people have all these other problems. And, Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of Epidemic, points to that. You know, he's not a doctor. Whitaker is an investigative journalist. And he investigated this in this kind of eye, investigated the rise of people becoming disabled. We didn't have all of this disability, 25, 30 years ago. I mean, that was when we had asylums that had thousands of people. And that's why we really have the doctors for them to perform their profession and not to advocate because they think it's something that may have something to do with, quote-unquote, psychiatry. I agree with Sue. We do have to volunteer to go into the push. Because it's hard sometimes to get the push to get into to talk to med students and to get them to understand that they're responsible. You know, if this is a disease, which we know that it's not, if it is a disease, then they should have a test. I mean, that tells you right there. They don't have anything to test for it. So if they figure that it's psychiatry, they've got to send it to somebody else because they don't have any way of looking at it.
I think that's really absolutely important to get in. And Sue, I'm not sure if my side is having trouble with the lines or not, but if you want to call back in, call back in. And sorry if the lines are screwing up tonight. But I can say from teaching psychology at a college level, and it's just undergrad, but it's still that fundamental initial learning. The material that you're expected to have these young people regurgitate back to you is just often blatantly wrong, or only half of the story, and it's the priming for what psychiatry wants you to think about psychology and psychiatry gets in right at the beginning of the books. I can give a concrete example. When I started teaching, I guess this is going to be my 10th year I'm going into of teaching at the college level. And when I started, every single textbook at the beginning of the book had a chapter about the history of psychology that went over, like, the horrifying things that have happened before. And now the textbooks no longer have that and have, like, a little chart in them about, like, specific events in psychiatry's history. But it doesn't get into the whole issue of, past views on these things, of the spiritual aspects of how it was thought of earlier, or any of the horrors of the 19th century asylums or the early 20th century lobotomies and insulin and metrazole. So all of that's been wiped out of the books.
Why that is?
Well, because it's a machine, and they need to brainwash these young people before they get to a point of where they feel confident that they know what they're talking about. Because if they waited to give a medical doctor the information about psychiatry until that person got to their residency, their understanding of themselves as a thinker would already be too far along. And so at the very beginning, they start inundating them and indoctrinating them with these lies. And the tests also are false. And so they're studying to misinformation. And so by the time they actually get out to the point of where they're practicing, right, the misinformation is so second nature that to question it would just seem like, why did I just bother the last 12 years of my life to do this? Right? Think about what they have to give up in order to understand what a fraud they're perpetrating.
Well, it's important to understand the past because, you know, because psychology is not my forte, Dr. Tenney, it's yours, but it's important to remember the past because, as a historian, because if we don't remember the past, we're bound to repeat it. And some of the things that happened in the past, they just found more efficient ways of doing it. You know, people may not have lobotomies anymore, but
they do. Yeah, they're called either leucotomies or neurosurgery for psychiatric disorders. After lobotomy, they went to leucotomy, and then they went to a cingulotomy, rather. It was leucotomy, lobotomy, cingulotomy, psychosurgery, and now it's neurosurgery for psychiatric disorders. And there's even an article that explains why the terminology has changed over time. And how they intentionally stray away from words like lobotomy or psychosurgery because of their negative connotations. But yeah, there's still plenty of intentional brain damage that is being committed to the brains by psychiatry and neurosurgery.
So it's not all just chemical. I'm checking this out as wonderful about the internet as we're having this exchange, and I hope other people will call in, is that you can easily go now on the internet and find out all kinds of stuff.
I always say, don't take my word for it. Do your own research. And then let me know what you find, because I'm sure you're gonna, when you start looking for it and you know what's out there to look for, it's a wonder what you find.
One back in the late 1970s, and when I went to see him, he didn't even have speech. He was at Perry Point at a veteran hospital. He didn't even have speech. He was just as some creature that was walking around. But I didn't know that they still did it until I'm just looking at this large cache of information. It's called Neurosurgery for Mental Disorders. Wow. So... thank you, Lawrence. I did not know that they were still doing it. I thought that all of this, now that they use chemicals too.
Sue, are you back on? Sue, are you there? I guess we just missed you again, Sue. I'm sorry.
She might be fading in and out or whatever else. And Sue just sent a post to me of the video of the Judge Rottenberg Center, of the young man who was being tased.
Right.
I call it tased, but I guess being tortured is the correct word to say.
And it's different. And it's also different than tasers. It's different than tasers. These are things. These are patches that are attached to your skin, so they're not.
It causes burns.
They're
different.
Sue, are you there?
Hi, I'm there. Sorry. I got cut off. But anyhow, I just want to say one thing. I'm a bit tired tonight, but I wanted to say that I work for the Royal, it's Ottawa Hospital, the first hospital that tortured me when I was 17, my first admission in 1972. In the year 1990, that a peer of mine called me. She said, Joy Lee. Okay, I'll say that's my nickname. Hi, Joy Lee. She said, it's Marion. I said, hi. She says, I have a job for you. I said, what? She says, at the ROH. I said, are you nuts, Marion? I'm going to work in that torture chamber? She said, look, calm down. I want to talk to you for a minute, okay? She said, I have a program called, the consumer as expert, people that have been psychiatrists, like yourself. Some are on the fence. Some are pro-psychiatry. And, of course, she said to me, okay, do we like your views way to the left? So did I join this team called the Consumers as Experts? Some were pro-psychiatry, some were on the fence. Of course, I'm way left, eh? And we gave seminars to the staff, the psychiatrists, the nurses, etc., like on drugs, on electroshock, and all this. I worked there for 10 years. And the thing is, okay, I don't know whether that I'm the first, okay, the anti, okay, like the psychiatry activist, okay, that working for a psych hospital. I told Don White, and he couldn't believe it. But I worked there for 10 years. I have a video here at home. But the thing is, okay, the hospital that tortured me hired me. So, I mean, okay, so, I mean, if you want to swing your head around that one, go figure, eh?
Yeah, I think that that's always one of the problems that many people come up against. But I think it's important for people to know that that's going on. I found the article that I was talking about. It was I wrote about this in the devoiced dissertation, and so it says in an article published in the American Psychiatric Association Psychiatric News, Moran, 2004. Under the heading Clinical and Research News, the article's title reads, Psychosurgery Evolves into New Neurosurgery Approaches. In this article of January 2, 2004, Moran specifically stated, quote, one psychiatrist involved with studying the procedures acknowledged the caution with which researchers approach the subject and public comments about the research, in part because of the disastrous experience with frontal lobotomies performed on thousands of patients in the 1940s and 1950s, end quote. After barely addressing the mass murder and human rights violations which occurred during the era of lobotomy, this article stated that even the term, quote, psychosurgery should be, quote, eschewed today in favor of neurosurgery for psychiatric disorders.
That's something else. And just to let you know, when I was talking to Marion, I said, I'm not going to mince my words. I'm going to be anti-psychiatry. She says, I want to hire you because you are an anti-psychiatry person. And so I spoke with the panel. I was at the Speaker's Bureau at the hospital, and I never minced my words. I told them I was anti-psychiatry, and this is the way it was for me. Just to let you know.
Good for you. See, it can be done.
Never miss my words at the hospital. Some said, why? And one night, Marion talked to me. She said, we're going to a restaurant, and I want you to talk to the shrink students. As soon as they become a doctor, okay, they have a specialty, and some of them went into psychiatry. We're eating there, and some of them actually, okay, that their mouths drop and their food, during supper, when I told them what happened to me, they were in shock. Someone just stopped eating.
Hmm. Well, they need to know.
Well, of course they need to know. Of course. I never miss my words at the hospital as a speaker or anywhere. If I go on the radio, TV, I always tell them psychiatry is a sham. Psychiatry is torture.
It is torture. It is, and it's a crime against humanity. And if you'd like to call in, if you have something that you'd like to say, or if you're on the line and you want to talk at any point, press 1. If you'd like to call in, we have the special 800, it's not an 800 number, it's an 855 number. Tonight, we have a special toll-free line for the lower 48 states. And that is area code 855. 346-3351, area code 855-346-3351. If you're calling from area code 510, you just reached the Talk with Tenny tip line, but it's being used on air. So try 267-521-0167. Sorry if you all heard that clicking. But I do think it's important that people speak out. First-time callers are entirely welcome. You don't have to. You can tell a story. You can ask a question. You can make a comment. We don't need to agree. Feel free to call in, and I think what's important is that we're talking about it. The number is area code 267-521-0167. And we move further on.
And we still talk, talking about this, and this is 2014. I had no idea that people in 2014 that they were still doing this type of surgery.
Absolutely, and then they're doing, like, well, don't forget also what they're doing with the veterans. Oh, and if you're a veteran out there, thank you for your service, and I hope that you're getting the information and certainly the medical treatment that you need to mess what's happening with the VA. I can only imagine what's going on with the VA's psychiatric component. But I want to remind people about that article of the veterans where DARPA is planting implants, tiny electronic devices into the brains of veterans to try to reroute their chemical impulses to avert post-traumatic stress. This can only go badly. And then there's things like the vagus nerve stimulator that they're doing, Yvonne. All of that, I mean, that's all forms of brain damage.
Well, maybe it's a good thing that they're waiting. They say they have to wait a long time. We just had a story here where the top lead story tonight was 5,268 veterans in the D.C. area waiting more than 30 days for their first appointment, and maybe it's a good thing. I shouldn't say that because a lot of people have died because they couldn't get the proper physical care they needed, but, you know,
not getting involved with psychiatrics or absolutely, but the medical, the actual physical medical care that's mm-hmm. being denied. Don't get me started because I'll go for hours on it.
But they've been doing this for decades across. It's not something that just is the present administration.
That's
VA
right.
has been a mess for a long time.
That's right.
I live in an area where, and we have a high number of veterans. There is one block from me, there's VA housing. Either way, if I go east, if I go west, there's VA housing. We have, because in our communities, military service has been looked at in the past as a opportunity. So we have many people that are veterans. So we have there's a clinic at 6th and Chesapeake. And they have housing for the men and for the women, and even going the block in another way, they have housing. We have so many veterans that are out here, and luckily they do have some housing for them. But post-traumatic injury, I think, has been allowing people to take advantage of the veterans. And I could see where they have these long waits, and what they're doing is they're just giving them a prescription. And that's leading to many veterans becoming addicts, many of them dying because they abuse the chemicals, it's because they're taking them as prescribed. And
right.
when we see these stories, I think that the lesson from this from your radio show, Lauren, is that we should speak out, just as Sue said, we shouldn't mince words. We should speak out. We should, you know, write to the newspaper, to the blog. We should call into the TV and radio stations. Now, I'm getting to the point now where I'm going to start looking at the sponsors of even local news or even 60 Minutes and 48 Hours and these various other shows, because it doesn't seem like behavior is changing until their pocketbook is affected.
I'm sorry. I just need to mention, since you brought up the sponsors of the CBS shows, that, like, Viagra is who is sponsoring this. Pfizer is who is sponsoring this onslaught of lies and putting Tory up on a pedestal as a, quote-unquote, top psychiatrist in America. It's such a fraud, and it's Viagra that is the sponsor of that show on the internet. You have to sit through Viagra commercials in order to see this.
Oh, I gotta check this out. The funny thing, I'm not going to digress too much, but you know, Viagra was not, when they first made that medication, it wasn't made for sexual dysfunction. It was something where it was side effect. It was supposed to be made for, like, heart conditions and hypertension. That's what I understand. And then they found out this was a heart problem. In fact, if you look at this, this tells you how male society is, that they fast-tracked. I remember this guy who, I don't know if it was, well, he's a high-powered CEO who was head of a very company. I'm not going to call his name because I also don't want to get sued if I gave the wrong name. But he was talking about this on CNBC. This has been maybe over a decade and a half ago, and how this was a miracle that men would have. And, you know, they fast-tracked that. And Medicaid would pay for Viagra and those drugs, when in some states they wouldn't even pay for birth control. So I guess there's a lot of money to be made. They want to make sure that, like I said, I digress. But I've got to check that out. And Viagra really is the sponsor of this, in this information.
I think it's really good questions, and I actually was looking at, I think it was Fox News the other day.
Make you dysfunctional. So what happens? You take one drug, and it makes it so you can't function sexually. So they have something else to counter it. Boy, this is really greedy.
It's the business plan of a lifetime. It's about as good as the business plan for Eli Lilly causing diabetes with Zyprexa and then selling the diabetes pen. You know what I mean? Like this is how people cannot, like, how this can be allowable for profit. I mean, I think is another big issue. If you wiped the profit out of psychiatry, I bet you that would eliminate almost all of the force. I bet you it would.
Well, you know, in my ignorance as a young peer supporter, but I was doing a group at the state hospital. It took me many years to get legally in there, but I was doing a group, and I remember this one woman, and I never forget this because I was asking her what was it like to be well. And she said, suppose you can't remember, you don't know. And then she was going on, and she said something very important, and it rung true with me later on when I got more information. She said, I came here and I was okay, and then they gave me medication. They gave me this medicine, and that's what made me this way. That's what she said. She said, I was okay when I came here. And she related a story about, I think she was working for someone. She was abused by the employer, and she got pregnant. She was an older woman. And she said, I was okay when I came here, and they gave me this medicine, and that made me sick. Asking, was that possible? Like, and, you know, I was not as informed as I am now. That was like 20 years ago. But that I never forgot that. Because I was okay when I came here. You know, actually, virtually, she said her whole story was, you know, some bad things happened to her, and I guess she got put away into state hospital to hush her up. So, but this can happen today with assisted outpatient treatment. You know, you can be a person who has some bad things to happen to you, and people want to make you believe and other people to believe that there's something wrong with you. And I used to get, now most of these people have died or whatever. I used to see a lot of people like this that were older, like in their 70s and 80s, at our state hospital. They still have like a geriatric unit, although they're placing a lot of people out into nursing homes, which is in violation of Olmstead. But,
right, and Olmstead. Oh, Olmstead. Senator Kathy Young, who is the person who has put forth S-2225D 2013, the expansion of Kendra's Law. I saw a video of her on her page on the New York Senate, Catherine Young, where she's a proponent of sheltered workshops.
Oh, that's slave labor.
Yes, it is. It is slave labor. Just in case you didn't hear that, folks, slave labor. We're saying it. and she where she is in support of something. There's a Subcon Industries is one of the sheltered workshops that she was saying that she wanted to continue supporting, because something like, quote-unquote, the reality, you know, of it is that some people can't ever really get competitive employment. I'm paraphrasing there. But she says, quote-unquote, the reality of it is that some people can't get competitive employment. And you can see that right on Senator Katherine Young's webpage. She's a conservative, Republican conservative independent party, New York State Senate. And so she is the one who's the sponsor of renewing and expanding Kendra's law and eliminating the repeal date. But she also is a supporter. So the Subcon Industries, I want to know, are any of these sheltered workshops donating to campaigns?
You can go into the campaigns and see that sometimes they don't give directly. I know that Subcon, they're in Olean, New York.
That's right.
And they employ a lot of people who have developmental disabilities. And so do some of the other nonprofits that have, like, thrift shops and forced shelter labor. And for people who don't know what it is, what happens is people get paid much, much below minimum wage. I mean, virtually like, you know, a couple of dollars an hour.
And like piecemeal, like very often, like for every piece that they do or something like that.
Which is illegal for everyone else except for this kind of work. And I know that this is hard work because at one time my mother did factory work and you got paid by your piece. And I'm telling you, some of the most productive people that you could know are people who have developmental disabilities to do this work. But there are also people that do do this work in state psychiatric hospitals as well.
Right.
And although usually now they pay them just below the minimum wage. I remember my first rap group, we had some people that were bused from the hospital. They had been working. And since that time, they had a court case with the Department of Labor, but there were women that were there that had worked for $3 an hour. Some of these people actually had known over a period of time, and they talked about that, and it was perfectly legal for them to do that.
Right, and Senator Young talked in the video about how what they're doing with Olmstead is that it's not just limited to institutions and living environments, but all environments that somebody is in can't be segregated. And so that's one of the ways that they're getting rid of the sheltered workshops in New York, is by saying that it's segregated work. And so she disagrees with that, and she thinks that these are good and that we should be preserving them and figuring out ways of being able to keep paying people at, you know, below minimum wage rates and
sure
have them work all day long.
Are you sure that she's taking care of her people? You can very easily find out whether she's getting contributions from them or not, or if maybe if you have officers of corporation, they might be given. Usually people don't give money like that with the company name on it, except for the Koch brothers. But you can see if the officers of the corporation, on their website, they say that they have 200 employees and they have a lot of pitches here. And that kind of piecemeal work, as they describe it, it's really manufacturing what the people do at Subcon. It's assembly type work, and that's classified as manufacturing. And most people don't realize, but manufacturers in the U.S. get a lot of tax breaks, and they don't have to be.
One of the things that Senator Young said was that there was an economic head for them because they're getting their merchandise from local businesses, and so the businesses are profiting because they get it at, you know, like discounted rates or whatever, and nonprofit discounter, however that goes, I'm not sure. But whatever they're doing financially, that it's an economic head for them. And so that's the other, you know, they're being very clear that, well, oh, this may, you know, make this person feel good about themselves, which I don't know how, if you're not being paid like what your right minimum wage to get paid is, I don't know how that's supposed to make you feel good. But it's also an economic incentive for the county. And so she was publicly on her own webpage talking about how they're trying to work with for-profit businesses now to be able to keep these kinds of things alive or something, and it wasn't very clear as to what they were doing or how, but it's definitely something to watch, because somebody who thinks that it's perfectly fine to keep us in slave labor and that we'll never be able to really, you know, there's a section of us that are never going to be able to really get a competitive employment anyway, that this,
this
is a person
is very hard work. I don't want to think, it's not like the, sometimes people typically think about these type of jobs as being something where, like, oh, this is where the high school kid sits at the desk somewhere and answers the phone and someone comes in and they're really not producing anything. These are kind of, these are the people who, when you go into a store and you buy something and it's all packaged and assembled, there's somebody else that does that, and that they do have production. This, in the in a mail rooms where you have a mail sorting now, this is what those type of things. It's repetitive type work. It's not that you would say, well, it's not worth, we're doing this because it's not worth what they're paying. And I just want to say that, because in another life I was a tax auditor, but currently manufacturing industry in the United States, they get a special tax break. That's up and beyond their deductions. They get a special 3% deduction that they have. So even if you just make T-shirts, if you just do assembly, that's considered to be manufacturing. They get a special, this is a federal income tax. And many states have additional breaks because they want them to stay in this country. So on top of the fact that they're getting all these good tax breaks, they're also employing people who are, who would maybe have a hard time finding a job at very little wages. And it can vary, but they can be as low as a couple of dollars. So you could have someone working. I saw a news story just in 2014 where someone had done a story on a sheltered work where there were people they were working for. I'm not going to call the nonprofit's name because I'm not sure, but it's one of the ones where they collect clothes and they put them on the shelf or whatever, and people not getting even enough money, where they barely enough money to pay for their transportation to go to work. It's almost as if that the employers act as if they're doing them a favor by letting them come there to work.
Right, and that's of course part of just the insult to injury, and how we're preventing people from being able to meet their own goals, and calling their goals delusions, and locking them up and drugging them, and it's just it's terrible, and I thank God that I got out of it when I did. I really, really do, because I know I would not have been for long if that was the rest of my life, and that for somebody who is, you know, involved with psychiatry in a way that you don't want to be, you don't have to be forever, and there are ways out, and there are lots of alternatives. Yvonne was bringing up Robert Whitaker before, and Anatomy of an Epidemic. He's going to be one of the keynote speakers at the Mind Freedom Creative Revolution Conference in July, July 24th to the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House. It's going to be a jam-packed few days, and I'll be broadcasting live from there throughout the time. And so I'm very excited about that coming up.
And Mary Ellen Copeland is going to be there, too. Is she still going to be there?
It's my understanding, yes.
Okay, so, yeah.
Yes, and people from Hearing Voices Network and Coming Off of Psych Drugs Safely and Soteria House and Open Dialogue. There's going to be so many really, really good things going on there that people can really network and make new connections and get involved in a way that you might not have been involved up until this point. And if you want to get re-involved and haven't been around in a while and feel like you want to come back, this is a great place to do it. It's a fabulous retreat place, and it promises to be really exciting. And then July 13th at 6 p.m. to July 16th at 6 p.m. will be the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance will be hosting the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day Vigil, held in front of the on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany. And we sit vigil for 72 hours because that is how long that we can be detained, assessed, and treated. And we speak out against but like in places like Colorado where they're looking at like 9 days if the, depending on whether or not you get it there on a weekend, which is just horrifying that they can legitimately hold you that long to decide whether or not they're going to keep you. And this is with no psychiatric history. This isn't about involuntary outpatient commitment. This is just what any single person who is walking in the United States, this can happen to you, based on somebody else's say-so. And so we sit vigil for 72 hours to call attention to that and speak out against psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit. And it's a wonderful way to connect. And for from July 11th till July 13th during the morning when we're heading down to Albany, some of us will be meeting up at the Alliance's headquarters in Utica, New York, and we'll be spending a couple of days there and just having some time to relax and organize and look through some of the Alliance's 40-plus year history of being in existence and be able to really maybe get some good organizing work done in those couple of days prior to the vigil.
I just realized, and just listening to you, you know, when I was hospitalized, it was over the 4th of July weekend, and I didn't realize, I always try to make it a point to celebrate the 4th of July, and then maybe that's the reason why.
It's Freedom Day, yeah. And so I think that, you know, there's so many things going on and so many ways people can get involved. If you live near Brooklyn, New York, on June 19th, we're going to be having the vigil for Esmond Green from 4 to 6 p.m. in front of Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. And that also promises to be a very moving event. And if you, there's a Facebook page for it. And if you can't come in person, if you can join and share and let people know that the world is still watching and that they're not allowed to kill us and then falsify records about what it is they've done to us, that will matter. The reason that we got so much attention in Brooklyn, New York, 6 years ago when Esmond Green, when we first learned of her murder, was because people all over the world got involved and spoke out and posted things on Facebook and held little vigils where they were and lit a candle in remembrance of people who have lost their lives to psychiatry. And, you know, there are children who have lost their lives. Jessica Riley, for example, 2 years old diagnosed, 4 years old dead. Her parents, the psychiatrist got immunity to testify against the parents, and the parents are, because they were giving her the psychiatric drugs that the psychiatrist prescribed. And so this is something that is widespread. It is not ever talked about in the media. And that's one of the reasons why we're trying to do this show, so that we can give people an opportunity to talk about your own experiences and what's worked for you and any kind of work that you're currently doing now in terms of organizing or advocacy or peer support.
Lauren, did you talk to the VA about the what's his name, that Blair, who was shot.
Yes, Michael Blair.
11
times, yeah. After he had fallen to the floor because the hospital told his family to call 911 and refused him, and now he's dead. And so June 13th, I'm scheduled to call the district attorney's office to find out whether or not I don't know how much he'll be able to actually tell me, but I'm hoping that he'll have more information, and so I'm supposed to be calling him to find out whether or not a grand jury will be reconvened or where the situation is. But I think that this is another major issue that we're looking at, and things like the Murphy Bill, which, you know, may be dead, may not be dead, may be resurrected at the last moment. I mean, all we really need is one or two more big incidents between now and the end of
the
session.
People shouldn't be rejoicing so quickly.
Right.
Because if you can believe the news reports, and as I said, in Washington, I don't believe a bill is dead until it's been voted down or it's been deactivated in committee. And I haven't heard that yet. What they said is they're going to try a new strategy. And someone, I guess, leaked that to the press, and that was that they would try to pass some of the least controversial parts of the bill.
Which I really see as some of the most controversial. The least controversial in terms of they don't attack the money, so they get everybody off their backs because now everybody is not, you know, rising up because they're going to lose their industries and whatever. You know, the protection advocacy people. I mean, there are so many people that were rising up against this because of the money. But the education that they're planning on doing, the care coordination, which is a euphemism for involuntary outpatient commitment, as far as I'm concerned, and the research that they're going to fund, we really need to be very cautious about what they're considering non-controversial or uncontroversial. I just think it's really, we're in a dangerous part. I just want to give the number. It's area code 267-521-0167. And if you want to call the toll-free number, it's area code 855-346-3351. Area code 855-346-3351.
And I would urge people that sometimes people listen for a while and then they, you know, may call in later on. But I would urge people that are not calling because they don't have unlimited long-distance service is while we have the 800 number to make use of it, to call in. I know several people on the Facebook page, my Facebook page, and Lawrence also have been talking about various things, whether it's what's happening at Judge Rottenberg Center, there are other things, and I would just say, you know, call into the show because, you know, everyone doesn't have Facebook and Twitter. There are still some people that don't have it, and there are many people that, like Sue, Maxine, and a lot of other people, who called in where they've got this lived experience, and you think your experience or what you've observed that everybody knows is not. Like, I didn't realize that we were still doing lobotomies, but they just had changed the name, and all I had to do was to Google it and to see that some famous child star just died in 1999, 3 weeks after having the lobotomy done. So, you know, we have to educate each other because we don't know what is out there. There are provisions in some of these bills that are in state legislatures to extend the 72-hour hold to 5 days or longer. And you can imagine someone who's working a job and someone can hold you. I mean, I don't think even if you get arrested, they can't hold you without cause after so many hours. I mean, for someone who has a psychiatric label or previous history, there are all kinds of things they can do to you or to us that they can't do to other people. And
right, and that's like what Jason had brought up the other night about preventive detention and how even there it's usually seen as not acceptable, but if it's in the case of somebody who has a psychiatric history, then it, all of a sudden it's okay. And so
does not apply.
Right, so these rules and laws that are carved out just for this little group of people that we happen to fit into, I think that that's like at the base of what discrimination is about. Oh, because, you know, separate laws, like, you know. Here we are.
Even in the radio show, I changed my mind about the funding of hospitals by Medicaid dollars. I said, maybe that's a good thing because, you know, if you have a capacity, people will find some way to make it. I remember being in a meeting maybe about a year ago, and I always ask, here, and maybe that's why I'm not on that advisory group anymore, but I always ask, what's the population, what's the census population at the hospital? Is it coming down? And why is it not? And what's the private bed population? And I was told that, well, we have to have X number of beds just to keep things up. You know, just like you have in the business, they would say, you need X number of customers to pay staff, et cetera, whatever. Because I said, well, I'm looking forward to the day when our brand-new hospital, which is less than 4 years old, a lot of people think our state hospital doesn't exist, but it does, still exists. They have a brand-new building. I'm looking forward to it being turned into a police academy or something else. But you know, maybe not getting funding for a state hospital or having it compromised would be a good thing because then people would say, well, we can't hold on to this, you know, large monstrosity. Even though we only have 260-some beds, we have over 1,000 contract beds in private hospitals. A lot of people have to start looking at not just what you have for a state hospital, but how many contract beds you have around the city. So you might not have, or your state, you may not have, actually, the state hospitals are closing, but maybe somewhere else they have a whole ward of people who are in a private hospital. Even forensic or in some hospitals will allocate a whole ward if they get a contract from the state for committed patients. And I used to think that there was no way that a private hospital would have committed patients, but some of them do because they want the dollars.
Well, I think that, you know, closing down hospitals is never a bad thing, and so that comes from cutting money. But, you know, unfortunately, the way that they're going about doing anything, that's not what's going to wind up happening. And they're just going to, the way that our rights are going to be infringed upon and how with the electronic medical records, everything is going to be tracked and available for all of time. With who knows what kind of accuracy, if, you know, history proves any good for...
And God forbid that someone puts something in error there. You know how hard it is to correct
an
charge
error, yeah,
on a credit report that's incorrect or have your identity stolen? Could you imagine the nightmare that would present?
It really,
you know.
we're set up for it, and so it's time for a nonviolent revolution, and that we have to organize. We absolutely must be organizing and getting out and speaking, and letting people know why the way that the current administration is choosing to go about things and the legislature is going about things is not going to be helpful to us as a society.
And we have
again,
to not just do our public officials, but I see the news media as being complicit. I just don't understand, as a caller called in yesterday and talked about how this 60 Minutes report and how they had couch Tory. And I've been saying this for a while, you know, that they look to them as experts. They have assigned Tory and Jaffe as gospel. and no one questions anything that they say about assisted outpatient treatment. They don't even question that this is not treatment, you know, that they don't ask the right kind of questions, you know. How is this going to improve things? I mean, it's so surface. And people better wise up, because when they wake up, it'll be too late. I mean, this is what they did in the 1930s in Germany. They started out with people who had mental health and developmental disabilities, and because we were easy tickets. And then they went on to other marginalized groups, gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, Jewish people that they wanted, people of the Jewish faith who they wanted to take property, and to also promote another fear-mongering that's there. This is the same thing that's happening with these shootings, the fear-mongering that are making people believe. That's why I believe when the police come out, they feel like they have a license to kill. I don't think that they actually purposely do it, but the way it's couched, you know, danger to self, others, this is this dangerous person that's there. I've had many parents in their 70s, 80s who have children who are in state hospital talk about them being dangerous. When I ask them about it, it's something that happened 30 years ago when the person was a teen, but and not necessarily something, you know, very valid, but we're being programmed to think about the people in a subset of dangerousness, and that by itself puts us and everyone else at risk.
Absolutely, and to understand that this is going on all over the world, right? And so this article that came out in the UK in Mail Online is talking about children as young as 4 are being prescribed antipsychotic medications amidst fears the drugs are being routinely misused. And then, you know, you scroll down the article and it says, the number of children being prescribed with potentially harmful antipsychotic drugs has more than doubled since 2008, according to a new government report. More than 2,000 children under the age of 10 were recorded as taking an antipsychotic medication, including up to 110 toddlers under the age of 5. Overall, more than 12,000 people under the age of 19 were reported to be using antipsychotics in October of 2012 alone.
Well, in the U.S., it's not even the same too.
And I think that this is underrepresented, but I mean to make clear that this is and it's being reported. You know what I mean? Like, even though the numbers probably are on the low side, and they're only giving you a month instead of a year, and obviously in the U.S. it's happening, that this isn't a U.S. specific problem. That this is a problem
United
that is
Kingdom
affecting
and France. They're doing the same thing. And,
the entire world, right?
And because most of the people who sell these chemical interventions, they are international companies. You know, they're all over the
right, so
they're
right.
All
global,
over the world.
Right. So
they're making inroads into third world now too. You know, World Health Organization. You know, for many years, you would look at data in a place like India, and you'd say that the people that had, quote-unquote, I'm not claiming these labels, but like schizophrenia, that the person's integration into community was much higher than it was in the U.S. But now they're beginning the chemical interventions that weren't so widely available. Same thing in some places in Africa and South America. They didn't have access because of the cost, but their
outcomes were better. right? That was what the World Health Organization was trying to bury, that in places that didn't have psychiatry as American psychiatry is known, that the outcomes for things like quote-unquote schizophrenia were greater improvement.
The integration of the community, their ability to be involved in family business, work, to be married, those type of things. That's what they were using as indications. And when I hear things like that, it still harks me back to that woman that said, you know, when I came here, I was okay, and then they gave me this medicine, and that's what happened to me. So,
right, and it's such a crime. It's such a crime. I think Sue, are
hi.
Hi.
It's me. I'm on the line again. I wanted to say something. We know that with psychiatry, it harms people. It murders them. How come that, okay, that the UN is not doing anything to stop any of this? This is serious stuff. People are being tortured. They're being murdered. The pills are now, okay, that they shorten a person's life. Why is the UN, someone not looking in there and getting them to stop all this?
They are looking at it, and it's been in two of the last reports on the Convention Against Torture by the United Nations High Office on Human Rights and the Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture. And I know that, like, the World Network and CRUSP and other organizations are doing a lot to try to influence it. But I can tell you, when I took it to the commissioner in 2008 with other people, with We the People and other people who were involved, the commissioner wanted nothing to do with paying any attention to what the United Nations had to say, even though they're clearly, according to the Special Rapporteur's report, any state that is not in compliance with the Convention Against Torture is in violation of it and should be getting repercussions, but they're just not. And instead, they're going forward. So I don't know why. I don't know why they're going and creating more laws that will, with state power, sanction the use of torture on people. I don't know why this is allowed. Do you? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can suspect why it's allowed. We don't know for any certainty. Like I said, these the people that do all these things, the machines that you're talking about, you said a couple of shows ago, there's a lot of money being made.
Obviously, but Sue's line's been back and forth all night. If you're out there, Sue, I don't know. Do you have ideas as to why this is? And what to do to stop it, and how to get them to pay attention to us? Sue?
She's calling Canada.
Yes, I'm back again. Yeah, I got cut off, I guess, the bad lines or something. But, you know, you're right, Lauren, and I'm glad you told me this. I got to say something. This is like the Nazis. This is like we're living under their rule. This is scary, okay? This is even scary for me.
It's real now.
Because I cannot go to the USA, because on my files I try to commit suicide twice, and there are 19,000 people that have been outed by the FBI and RCMP and the border guards. If I go to the Pearson Airport, let's say to see Lauren, or go somewhere in the States, I'm going to have to get a doctor's letter to say I'm all there. I am all there. So I can't go to the States. I can't go to Hawaii, my dream world, for a week. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, and you know, we've been talking about these articles. I'm looking at one in the Star, in the World section, that Canadians stunned to learn they have police records despite never being found guilty, and so
exactly.
they're preventing you from coming in. I'm what if I go visit Canada? Are they going to let me back?
Yeah.
Well,
How are they going to let me in?
People with HIV, they were doing the same thing up until here recently as well. But, you know, it really is a violation of your freedom of travel has been curtailed. And it's, again, what I call is they tie dangerous mental health, mental illness, even if you don't believe in it, but those are the terms they use. They tie that to, like, violence prevention. it's really kind of laughable. I think people should be, they should be more worried about people that come in here. And
it's a violation of privacy rights. Why do we need to know this?
It's not communicable because even if it's not an illness, and even if it was, it's not communicable. It's caused by Tory, by cat poop, and it's such a bad thing that this kind of worldwide discrimination is being perpetuated. And
it's not a laughable thing, though. It's not a laughable thing for a Canadian like me that has suicide on a mental health record, and I can't get to Hawaii. That's my dream. It's not a laughable thing. I'm not putting no one down, but this is serious, serious crap here. 19,000 people in Canada labeled with suicide on your mental health record. You cannot get to the States. You're barred, and they tell that in front of your family and your partner, right in front of everybody. You are barred from the States. This is serious. This makes me angry as hell that I cannot go to the States. I know I get my passport. Not a problem getting a passport, but I cannot go to the States. They're going to tell that in front of everybody around me. You are barred. Come with us to an office. This is horrible. This is really horrible because a lot of people don't even know. They go to the airport and they're told, you buy your ticket for the airplane. You pay your hotel in Hawaii. Everything's paid for, and then you're told, no, you can't come in. This is serious. This is really, really
and
making
they can't,
angry.
Why I say it's funny is because they can't keep terrorists out of the United States.
Right.
But they can keep somebody that...
As soon as you're in the airport and you show your passport, they see your name, they say, sorry, you are barred from the U.S. Come with us. You got to go with them into a room, and they ask you, say, sorry, but they say, okay, right on your passport, it says, like on their computer, we found out through police sources, you were suicidal in 1999, you are barred from the U.S., and you need a doctor's letter to say you're okay, you're stable. I think that's a huge violation of our rights going into my
Absolutely.
Mental health records. I think it's horrendous.
Is it being fought?
Yes, it is, because a lady of 63 years old went this year, she lives in Toronto, and she was at the Pearson Airport, and she wanted to fly to Miami with her partner and her family. They looked at her airport and said, you are barred from the States, Mrs. So-and-so. They had to bring her to her room and say, you are barred from the States because on your fall in 1989, someone called from your house 911 to say that you wanted to kill yourself. It's on a medical file. And so they said to her, you need a doctor's letter to say basically, that you're okay, you're stable. She was not allowed to get on the plane. She can't go into the U.S.
It really is horrifying.
I think you saw that article because I posted that around, and this is horrible. So someone like me, Sue Clark Winberg, I get my passport, and my husband's with me, and they will say, Mrs. Winberg, you can't go into the States. Follow us to a room. 19,000 people have been targeted. All their files have been sent to the States, FBI and the Border Guard. Huh?
To rent the medical students, there was a posting that came in the Star. It said that that over 200 medical students signed a petition to stop this. They said that this would cause people to cause people to flee psychiatry.
Yeah.
It really is horrendous. I keep on thinking, Sue, we should test it out. You should come. We should set up a conferencing. You should come talk.
Yeah, I really think a lot
it's
of people
horrible.
Know this. And our friend tonight that did my wash, because you know I have broken shoulders, what happened, he came and he told his job coach, and she was horrified. She said, what? Canadians with suicidal tendencies are not allowed in? And she was shocked. And a lot of people, you know, I tell them, you know, that, okay, I'm an activist against electroshock. A lot of people think, oh, I thought that was taken away a long time ago, electroshock. I thought it was gone like 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
Well, that's why we had to have this show. Because I thought that there was no more lobotomies,
like,
not just
show.
Down years ago. Yeah.
So
you
would
know,
you... I'm just wondering
yes.
if you would tell people how they can find the international campaign to ban electroshock?
Yes, I'll tell them, but my website is easy. intcamp.wordpress.com. And now I want to lobby the, okay, I'm in Ottawa, Canada's capital, so I can lobby both the MP and the MPPs on this and send a lot of emails, and I want to meet them in person too, some of these on the Hill. You know, I call it, you know, the turkey land, and okay, that means politicians. A lot of them are turkeys, according to me. But anyhow, you know, I mean, with more of the respect, I mean, I'll go up and shake their hands and tell them that we have to ban electroshock. But we know, like, a lot of politicians sit on their duff, and they don't do much, but they collect $100,000 a year or more. But just give them a little nudge by just a little nudge, you know, political, just a little nudge, you know.
And I think this brings us right back to what we were talking about earlier. Know who you're voting for. Get involved with your
yes.
local legislators. Get involved with your state legislators. Get involved, period.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that they know that you're in their district and that you're a voter. And tell them what it is you want and why. And I think one of the things that has been most effective in at least getting information, and if not actually getting any kind of action out of it, is having a relationship developed so that when the issue that you need to have addressed is up and ready to be dealt with, that they already know you and they don't have to spend the time getting to know you or what you're about. So before things come to vote, like tomorrow, call your local legislators. Say, hi, I'm a voter in your district. I'd like to talk to somebody about things I care about. Can I talk with an aide? Get their name and develop a relationship with them. Periodically give them a call. See what's going on. See if there's any legislation you're interested in. See if there are ways that you can even help, you know, to get involved with maybe town halls that they're doing or other things, and go and speak out in these venues.
Who's the decision maker? If you're in different state legislatures or even in provinces, if there's a committee that covers a particular thing, you want to know who is the committee chair. You want to know in their staff who is covering that issue, because it's not possible for every elected official to be sometimes knowledgeable. What they do is they rely on other people. And you can be one of those people that they rely on. As we have seen so painfully, that a lot of our news media are relying on people who are of questionable ethics and integrity. But you can be the same thing for the legislature, same thing for your local press. So you're so correct. I find that we need to find who these people are, because if you repeat a lie long enough and repeat it enough, you think it's true. So we have to find a way to break these untruths down. And they, you know, they keep hearing and seeing the same thing. So they believe that it's true, and they start repeating it and using it for justification. I think one of the things that happened with the Murphy bill is that there was a I don't know if you could call it the way that this alarmed our community so much that there are a lot of people that are not on our call, that's not on Facebook, not in social media, but a lot of people were descending on their representatives and saying, oh, this is a bad idea. And that's why the Republicans are having to go back into their huddle. The war is not over with yet. But this happens. They're they're waiting for a regroup so that they can find another way to push through their agenda. This is a war that's happening, and we cannot, this is not 1930. Things can move a lot faster, and you'd be surprised if a law could be put in effect that overnight things can change for us.
I mean, it literally can happen overnight, just the way that the Thompson bill on the 28th was put on the floor and on the 29th was voted. And what they did was they added more money to the NCIS system to start collecting mental health records. And so don't underestimate how quickly things can happen and how vigilant we must stay. And to reach out to your legislators and let them know what your opinions are, and to be vocal about it, and that is it's our right, but it's also our responsibility.
I'm gonna say a bad thing, and sometimes people think that maybe something they have an interest in, maybe a conference or some small niche funding, they think that is a big threat, but the worst threat is if the people who participate in these things are not free to do so. So, negotiations sometimes occur for other people's interests and not for the interest of the whole. So you have to keep an eye, because it's not unheard of, at least in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, it's not unheard of that in the wee hours of the night, an amendment is attached to another bill that's very popular. I gave an example online. I said, the Energy and Commerce Committee, it wouldn't be unforeseeable that someone would attach to a heating bill, a bill that would provide heat for low-income persons in the Northeast, they would attach it to that. It's something that everybody would want passed. And these issues, other people may not see as being a slippery slope that we see it as. So you do have to be vigilant. And I thank Lauren for providing this vehicle for us, because this is 48 states, and hopefully people who are hearing this will send emails to their friends, call them, and tell them about the radio show, because this is a way that we can connect and find out what's going in Seattle, what's going on in Phoenix, what's going on in Chicago, Atlanta, because this is happening other places, and we've got to make sure that no domino falls.
I think
to get this all over the world quick, I mean, if there's playwrights or writers, anyone connected to Hollywood, I'm going to send a script about my life, the Sue Clark story, because I know the movie, The One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, got worldwide attention. And if we had a play on Broadway, we got to get the world attention of about our subject quick. I know it's not going to happen overnight, but I hope someone can get their story out in a film worldwide or a play, because we need to get the word out in the world quick. And that's one way how to do it. That is just one example that our group, the ICB, will try. I'm a writer. I'm going to learn to be a playwright, and I hope someone picks up my story, because it is an important story. I've been through everything with psychiatry. I have not been in forensic, and I have not been in, the addictions. I've been in every other program available there. But the whole thing is, we need to get the story out quick. So if there's playwrights out there, write your story. Send it to Hollywood. If you got your story, or actors, go to Broadway. I know it sounds facetious, but really it's not. We need to get the word out quick all across the world. It's going to take many
absolutely
years.
I just also want to point out that there are quite a few film things that are going on. Paula Joan Kaplan has a couple of little films out that are really worth looking at, of shorts that are really worth taking the time to look at. The Mad in America Film Festival, I believe, is going to be in October. So there are venues that people can submit their videos or films to be seen by people who have a shared interest in getting the word out about the damage and fraud of psychiatry. And so the thing, I'll talk more about that next time, the Mad in America Film Festival, and have more up-to-date information. But I think that, you know, to get to the mainstream, to get to the public, that we have to keep on working to do that, and speaking out and creating art and creating music and other kinds of theater or play or videos is definitely a fabulous way to go ahead and get to people who might not want to sit and, you know, read a book or something about it. But if you can
There's a better way to do it in the film festival, because, Sue, not to be a naysayer, but sometimes when we have good products, we send it to Hollywood, the story gets changed. I think about The Beautiful Mind.
Oh, yeah, what a crime that was.
And so when you send your stuff to Hollywood and you want to get it out, sometimes it does not, you know, I don't have any screenwriting experience, but this is what I've heard other people say, is that they didn't recognize the story. I knew someone who's written 3 or 4 books, and the person had got an offer to do a movie of the week many years ago about one of her books, and they had even sent her the advance, and she sent the advance back, and they asked her, why did she do it? She said, it was a mystery type series about a black maid who solved these mysteries. I woke up in the middle of the night in a sweat, and I saw Blanche, and they had turned her into Aunt Jemima. And once you sell your stuff, you sometimes don't have. So sometimes having things be in a film festival like this, or like the Sundance or something else where it gets popular, independent film, where it's
where you can maintain
going.
creative
control.
Rights.
You know, that's saying because the John Nash story. You know, I met him twice, had a short conversation with him. By the time they made that movie, it was 20 years since he had medication.
And they just rewrote the end as they wanted to write it, as propaganda for this industry. We're almost out of time here, so I just want to thank you both for calling in, for all the people who have been listening in on the phone. I also want to thank you for people who are online listening. Thank you. I encourage you to call in. If you would like to talk to me offline, my number is area code 718-273-8708. That's the Talk with Tenny tip line. If you'd like to be a guest on the show and talk about some organizing activities that you've been through, or your life, or other ideas that you have about psychiatry. If you have an idea for a show of things that you would like to have covered, or if you have a tip about a human rights violation that you know is being committed against somebody, or a death that you think needs to be exposed and investigated, you can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. I want to remind you, June 11th, we're going to have the big follow-up episode of Electroshock, focusing on informed consent and litigation strategies. And Deborah from ectjustice.com will be on, sharing her stories of both being a survivor of shock and somebody who was able to settle out of court on a malpractice suit. So I'm going to thank you all for talking and ask you to keep on talking. And until I talk to you next time, talk to you soon.